Okay. Questions. Yes, you need to turn in the hard copy here, and then the TA also sent a mail saying he wants the soft copy sent to a specific Gmail account that he set up. Okay, look up. If you did not get that email, you know, you should look up.
It's in the blog.
Yeah, it's in the blog, and probably it's also on the mail archive. So the important announcements are all definitely on the mail archive. You know, so there's an email address that he wants that sent. Other questions?
The due date for Homework 1 is Tuesday.
I said 12th, right?
Yeah,
I said 12th. 12th is like next Tuesday. Next Tuesday. 12th is next Tuesday. I mean, it's written on the homework itself, and it's next Tuesday, yeah. And so, in fact, today the list assignment is due, and I realize that tomorrow is the list recitation by Lei Tang. I could admit that this was just bad planning on our part, but however, I would say it's part of a grand design. This was so that people who had trouble completing this assignment zero know that they have trouble with Lisp, and they are the ones who need to go get the help from the TA. Okay, as I said earlier, the zeroth assignment on Lisp is going to be very small weight, negligibly small weight, and it was mostly only to force you to come to terms with your Lisp expertise, okay, rather than come to terms with it for project one, which is actually going to count a lot. I mean, you know, project one onwards are real projects, and so if you don't know Lisp, this is the time for you to have figured it out and then learn more of it, you know, so that the project one would be easier. Yes, sir.
Both the Lisp presentation, we all got a late times email. Some of us can't make it at that period because we have classes. So I sent him a reply saying, you know, is it possible for another presentation?
That's between you and him.
Right, so
that's usually it's between you and him. See, the thing that you have to realize normally is when from our side, when we send mail, very few people actually show up. I think it's unfortunate that somebody who wants to show up cannot make it on that time. So I think if there are enough people like that, he might do it again. If not, he'll just talk to you one-on-one. Okay, so that's likely to be the case. And then there's going to be, I think, Will Cushing sent a separate mail for those people who wanted to go to the class recitation, homework and class recitation, so their things that were done in the class as well as things that are relevant to the homework could be repeated, and you can ask more questions. Again, these are going to be, he's going to do this on an experimental basis. If people don't find it useful, and if he didn't find that it was worth his time, you know, it may not happen again, you know, and to the extent you guys find it useful and he finds it worth his time, then he'll continue. Okay, those are optional. You don't have to show up. This you have to show up because you're going to be graded on this. 9-12 is the homework one. Somebody sent a mail to the blog saying there was some confusion. They thought that somehow this was going to be held after the homework is due, but that's not the case. It's in fact held on this Thursday, and then so you will have a whole weekend to further digest the material, etc. Okay. Any other questions? So you have to make sure that by the time you leave, you give me the hard copy version of the assignment here. Okay. And then this is not just people screaming that there's so many things happening in the class already in the beginning of the semester. It's just, this is Edward Munch's scream, which was actually stolen from the Norwegian Museum of Art last year, and they found it last week. Apparently not too much damage has been done, so I don't know, how could you tell, but that's the story about that. The way I heard it, it was like a nice mid-afternoon robbery in Oslo. They just walked in and then showed guns and took paintings and left. You'd think that will only happen in New York, but apparently it happens in Norway too. We are going to continue with A-star search. Towards the, unless you have other questions that you want to stop me and ask. Okay. So to last class we ended by saying that if we can somehow provide a lower bound estimate, so the thing that we found last class was that the uniform cost search, which takes costs into account, can be easily misdirected, misled by the fact that things that look good in short term, right in front of you, actually might take a very circuitous path to the goal. So you would keep going in this blind alleys before you find the optimal cost goal. Okay, so then we talked about what if every node is not only, and every node during the search knows how costly it was to get to that node from the root node. That's just part of the search, because every node has a pointer to its parent, and so it knows the cost of coming from itself, from the parent to it, and add that to the cost of the parent itself, that would be the cost of this node. Okay? And so that normally you call that G value, and so every node N knows its G value, G of N. And what we were doing was we were prioritizing the search queue in using GN, so that the low G value nodes are expanded before the higher G value nodes. Okay? And we talked about how that can be misled. And then we said, well, if every node not only knows about its G value, but some estimate of how far is it to go from that node to the optimal goal node, optimal goal. Okay, if that estimate can be given, and so now this, the actual value is H star N, that's the true cost, true optimal cost of going from a particular world state to the optimal goal state from there. Okay, and we talked about how it should be too costly to give this, because if you give this, in essence, you have solved the search problem many times over. You have figured out the optimal path from every node to the goal node, in essence. Okay, so instead you try to find an estimate which is somehow easier and cheaper to compute. Now we ended the class by talking about what might be useful for such a what might be the useful properties for such heuristics, and we talked about the fact that as long as for all n, h of n is less than or equal to h star of n, that means you never overestimate the cost of any node to the goal node. You never overestimate. Okay? Then you would still end with the optimal node. Okay, remember that in terms of optimality, when you end, by definition, you must be optimal, because nobody is going to check whether you're optimal or not. And so we argued that, and we'll argue again today as to, in somewhat more theoretical fashion, but last time we gave intuitive reasons as to why, as long as you do a lower bound estimate, as long as the cost is not overestimated, you're guaranteed to find the optimal solution. Okay, but you might find it faster, because now what happens is each node is now being prioritized in terms of its F value, F of n equal to G of n plus H of n, where G of n is recursively defined as the length of the path from the root node to that node that you keep track of during the search, and H of n you compute, and you either have a lookup table or you compute on demand for that node what is the estimate of the cost from going from that node to the goal node. Now, I'll spend a lot of time in today's class talking about where good heuristics come from. It's a very, very important thing you're going to learn in this course. But let me give you at least one example about good heuristics. Now, remember that this good heuristics better be satisfying. So this is called the admissibility property. And the other thing we know is for all n, if h1n is always less than or equal to h2n, which is less than or equal to h star of n, and if so, you have two possible estimates that you can use, you'll always use the bigger estimate. Because as long as they're admissible, that means they're still lower than the true cost. And if you are lucky, you really would like to have H star, which star is less than or equal to H star. That would be the very best heuristic you can ever get. So the closer you can get to the true heuristic, true caste, perfect heuristic caste, the better off you are. That's why you would say that this is the informedness. So you would say that H1 of N, if given two heuristics, if one heuristic is bigger than the other heuristic across the board, it gives a bigger estimate across the board, and yet it's still less than the perfect heuristic. Okay, then you would always like to use it. Again, makes sense because you know you are actually trying to be as close to extra as possible. Okay, so these were the things we talked about, and now we're going to actually provide. So I said you need to have some idea about the kind of these estimates and where do these estimates come from. We'll talk about this again next time, but in a minute. But the general idea for getting these estimates is you take the problem, abstract it, act as if some of the constraints in the problem don't exist. Okay, and solve the abstracted problem. Normally, solving the abstracted problem is cheaper than it's always the case that solving the abstracted problem is cheaper than solving the original problem. Okay, and so let me think of a very simple scenario. I want to go, suppose I have all sorts of tables in this hall, and I want to go from, I'm a robot, right? I'm a mobile robot. I want to go from here to the corner of the room. Okay? During every point in my search, I'm trying to figure out from the wherever I am, what is the shortest path to the corner of the room. Now, depending on the way obstacles are arranged, the shortest path might involve going around the tables, make double backing on your path and going, right? So the true cost could be quite, and the true path could be quite complex. Now, what would I like to do if I want to abstract the problem? Abstract all the tables away. Act as if I can walk through the table. Okay? Act as if obstacles don't exist. If obstacles don't exist, what is the shortest path between me and the corner? Straight line. How hard is it to compute a straight line distance? It's like square root of x1 minus x2 square plus y1 minus y2 square. That's it. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the most important thing about heuristics is not how do you get heuristic for Manhattan distance, how do you get heuristic for some other problem, but the general principle for heuristics, which is you get heuristics by abstracting problems. So whenever you have a hard problem to solve, you act as if some constraints don't exist. Solve that problem. As long as that's cheaper to solve, you would have an estimate that will be a lower bound estimate and a true cost. Straight line distance is guaranteed to be the shortest path between any two points. Irrespective of how the obstacles are arranged, straight line distance between two points is guaranteed to be the shortest cost. Okay? Now, of course, it turns out that, you know, you could always could have taken h equal to 0, too. That's one possibility, right? Let me actually, since I saw this, Okay, so this is actually my problem I'm talking about. This is crossing from some initial state there to some goal state here. And I have some crazy obstacles there, okay? So the first idea is I'll assume that obstacles disappear. In which case, straight line distance would be the shortest path. And so, solving the abstract problem exactly will give you a lower bound on solving the real problem. Now, is this the only abstraction for this problem? No. Maybe what I would like to do is I'll act as if all these obstacles are circular. You know, they're all non-uniform shaped obstacles. Suppose I act as if the obstacles are circular. Okay, so in some sense, I'm ignoring the shape constraint. I'm making them all circular. Now, the question then is, how do I find the... So it turns out that finding the shortest path from here to here, when there are circles, is slightly more complex, only slightly more complex than finding the straight line distance. Okay, but it's not that costly, not that hard. And even better approximation would be to find a polygonal obstacle, a polygonal approximation to the obstacle. Now, when you're talking about polygonal approximation, the more sides the polygon has, the better the approximation. And the better the approximation, the better the connect, the distance, the lower the distance between your estimate and your true cost. But oftentimes it's also the case that by the time, in terms of computing the H value using this versus this versus this abstraction, which do you think is cheaper to compute? Which do you think is cheaper to compute? The higher up one. Which do you think, if computing the heuristic is not counted as part of your search time? You have a rich uncle who would bear the cost. Okay, which heuristic would you rather use? This one. Right? So this is actually, you know, this picture is very important. It turns out that there is a this picture exists for every problem. Doesn't look exactly like this. There is a picture for this, but like that for Manhattan, for the 15 puzzle problem. Okay, so remember the 15 puzzle problem, right? Since I'm talking about this, let me do this altogether. Okay, so where do the heuristics come from? For path planning on the plane, you can assume away obstacles and then the distance will be a straight line distance. Or you can assume that the obstacles are circular, or you can assume that the obstacles are polygonal. One question. Why did I take inscribed circles and not circumscribed circles for the obstacles? Those of you who figured this out, you know, you should pat yourself on the back. Okay, that's a very important point. You considered inscribed rather than circumscribed circles because this way you will never overestimate the cost. If you did the circumscribed circles, it's possible that there is actually a way to go between these two obstacles, but the circles are touching. And so you think it's not possible to go between the obstacles. And so you'll miss a path. You understand? Okay, so you are removing constraints. Here it was obvious because you remove the constraint by just removing the entire obstacle. Here it looked as if you are removing the constraints of irregular shape, but then you can actually make an irregular shape one, a regular shape one, and make the problem harder to solve. Not harder in terms of search, but harder in terms of having a probability that there exists a solution. That's why here you do inscribed circles. This is very important. It better be the case that that's what deals with the admissibility here. Okay, this was obvious because Euler proved it for us. Euclid or Euler, one of them, Euclid, proved it that between any two points on the plane, the straight line distance is the shortest distance. There is no other distance that's shorter. So we can just use his proof. Serve us a real time. Okay. So now going back to my other problems, if I have 8 or 15 puzzle problems, are basically sliding tile puzzle problems, how would I go about making heuristics for them? How do I make the estimates? Remember that in the sliding tile problems, what you do is you have one, I mean, do people remember? If I have a picture, I'll show you. Okay, there is a picture. So that's the sliding tile problem. Okay, so here is one configuration where the blank is here and I want to go from that to this configuration. The blank should be in the front and 1, 2, 3 all the way up to 15. So I want to compute how far is this from this. The true cost would tell me exactly the number of movements that are required to go from here to here. Now in this puzzle you know that the constraint is that this guy cannot jump into the air. This guy cannot jump into the air. Okay? And so the only way that you can go, you can shift the configurations is you move tiles into the blank space, which conceptually speaking is easier to think of as moving the blank around. So instead of thinking tiles being moved into the blank space, you better think of it as blank being moved around. So blank can go here, blank can go here, but blank can only go like horizontally, vertically. That's all it can do. Okay? So now question is, if I want to abstract this problem, what do? I could again, yes sir. Not just the two tiles, no. Basically, I have this configuration, I want to go to this configuration. So what is the cost of going from the, what's the estimate on the cost of going from this configuration to this configuration? That's what I want to know. No, let's start simple. Okay, what's the simplest thing you can do? You can think that you will jump. You know, you will jump. Okay, so one thing you can do is you can say every tile can be lifted physically and swapped into its position. That would make the problem easier to solve, right? That would make the problem easier to solve. So how many moves would you make that way? The number of tiles that are in the wrong position, those are the guys that need to be moved. Every guy who's in the wrong position, lift it up, put it in the right place. And if that position is being occupied by somebody else, that guy is lifted, put it in his right place. So the number of tile moves you make are equal to the number of misplaced tiles. So in this particular case, one is in the correct position, two and three are in the correct position, four, five, six, seven are in the correct position. Okay, wait, 8, 9, 10, 11 are in the correct position, 13 is in the wrong position, 14 is in the wrong position, and 15, I'm sorry, 13 is not, okay. So 12, 14, and 12, okay, 12 is in the wrong position, right? 15, and the blank. So the three misplaced tiles, that's all. The three misplaced tiles. That would be a way. Okay, now here's an interesting question. If I compute the estimate this way, how badly off can I be on the true cost? How badly off can I be on the true cost? So 100%, 200%, 1500%, what? What do you think? If I compute the true number of moves as just, you know, you estimate it as just the number of misplaced tiles, how off do you think you could get? Turns out that you can be infinitely off. Okay, I mean, I'll send you a mail about the history of tile puzzles. In essence, it turns out that in tile puzzles, I can give you two configurations such that you can't actually go from one configuration to the other configuration at all. Okay, all you need to do to go from, to give you such a impossible configuration is start from a configuration, physically lift the tiles, swap their position. Okay, and then make some more legal moves. And you will get a new configuration. Now, this new configuration cannot be reached from the old configuration. That's all. So, it turns out that in tile puzzles, there are exactly two groups. Okay, there are two permutations such that you can't go from one permutation group to another permutation group by making any of these moves. Now, that's interesting. If that would be neat stuff to know if you're just interested in slide puzzles and nothing else. The bigger issue here is when you abstract the problem, the distance you are from the true cost could be arbitrarily high. But the only thing you care about is, for admissibility, it's a lower estimate, that's all. Okay. Now, the other type of heuristic for 8 puzzles, 15 puzzle problem, that works better, okay, that works better is what's called Manhattan distance heuristic. Okay. The Manhattan distance heuristic says, yeah, you know, be unreasonable, but be reasonable in being unreasonable. Okay. So act as if each tile can be shifted to its position without caring about other people surrounding it, but in going there, march in the right way. Okay, so you know, for example, that you can, if you are in this position and you need to go to this position, it's not just one move. Even if nobody exists, even if you can walk through people, you actually have to make a move like this and make three moves like this. Or make three moves like this and one move like this. It's less unreasonable than the previous one. It keeps at least one of the constraints, that is, the way you move pieces is still not just one fell swoop, you don't get to go there. You make multiple moves to get to the position you want to go to, even if you can walk through people. And so to go from here to here, it's one, two, three moves. And at that three moves, actually, you can think of that as a Manhattan distance. You know, in a grid, Manhattan distance between two points is defined essentially as the absolute value of the difference between x1, x2 plus y1 and y2. That's it. So you take the x coordinate difference and the y coordinate difference and add them up. That would give you the Manhattan distance. And it's called Manhattan distance presumably because the rest of the old world had interesting curvy roads, and Manhattan is one of the first places where they actually had horizontal and vertical streets. And so in Manhattan, if you ignore Broadway, the usual way you go from place to place is make these grid-shaped moves. Okay? Now, is Manhattan distance better than the displaced tiles distance? Yes or no? Yes, because it will always be larger than the misplaced tiles, and it will still be smaller than the true cost. It will still be smaller than the true cost. Okay, so in this particular case, if you just consider the two misplaced tiles and trying to put them into the right position, the only thing that you care about, it turns out that Manhattan distance here is 9 moves, whereas the misplaced tiles, depending on whether you count blank or not, is 3 or 2. And the true cost for this problem, if I remember correctly, I don't have it here. The true cost is, I know that you can't, and I'm hoping that you won't ask me to prove this to you, but the true cost for this problem, I believe, is something like 53. Pretty large. I'm not a good puzzle guy, okay, so I may well be wrong. But these two, the numbers that we did get are definitely cheap. I mean, they're definitely lower bounds. And they're easy to get. Yes, sir. The Manhattan distance, okay, so let's see, what did we say? Okay, what are the places that are, so the misplaced tiles were, 12 is in the wrong place, okay, and it needs to go from here to here, so 1, 2, 3 moves for 12 to get to its right place, and then what else is in the wrong place? 15, it needs to go from here to here. That's right here, right? So it needs, it's right here, it needs to come here. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So 6 moves for 15, 3 moves for the other guy, and then the total is 9 moves. No, you are actually thinking for each tile, you assume that you get, so you're given the ability to walk through people. But you are not allowed to fly. Okay. So you still legally walk. So in Manhattan distance, even if you want to, walk over pedestrians, you'll still have to go. I mean, unless you also start walking over buildings, okay, even if you don't mind walking over pedestrians, running over pedestrians, to go from place to place in Manhattan, you have to use the Manhattan distance. There may be screams, but at least, you're following the rule of, the road rules. Yes, so basically you're assuming that the only moves that you count, in this particular case what you're doing is, it actually turns out that there's another problem. If you in fact start counting the blanks position too, it's not guaranteed to be a lower bound. I can make a scenario where if you count how far blank is from its place, then it's no longer going to be a lower bound. Now remember that when I said admissibility, this is a for all property. Even if there exists one node where you are bigger than the true cost, you're no longer admissible. Now, so you don't get a badge called admissibility. Now, when you don't get the badge called admissibility, what happens is you are not guaranteed to be optimal. You may well be optimal by luck, but you are not guaranteed to be optimal. Yes? I'll give you an example where counting the blank also would give you actually more than the true cost. Okay? So the simplest way to think about it is only look at the real tiles and their position. Okay? And then if count the number of places they are off by. Now, so Manhattan distance, is it costlier or cheaper than normal misplaced tile distance to compute? In terms of computing, which is costlier? Is it costlier or cheaper? Slightly costlier. Does your computer scare you? Yeah, no big deal. It's just really very close. Okay? And you assume that Manhattan distance heuristics would do better in practice than misplaced tile heuristics on problems. And in your first project, you will find this. Okay? Now, here's my question. Can you have... Okay, so here is Here's an interesting slide, and I'm actually doing this in the wrong order, but I'll put them in the right order by the time you look at them. So if you use Manhattan distance heuristic, so the tile puzzles are called the sort of fruit fly of the search community. So people who don't, they forget about the rest of the AI, they only want to improve search algorithms, better and better and better search algorithms. And if they do improve it, they try to see whether they can solve tile puzzle problems, all the Rubik's Cube problems. Okay, and it turns out that 15 puzzle problems can be solved. So any random configuration which is solvable, remember I told you that it's actually it's possible to make initial goal state combinations which can't even be solved. Any random combination of initial and goal state which is solvable would be solved optimally in 15 puzzles. In 15 puzzles. 15 puzzles will be what? 4 by 4 puzzle. Okay? In time that won't kill us. Essentially, it can be solved currently, you know, without people losing completely their patience. Okay? By the time you come to 24 puzzles, we are hitting the state of the art. 24 puzzle is 5 by 5. 24 puzzle is 5 by 5. Okay? It'll be interesting actually for you to count the number of distinct states. They're hugely larger in the 24 puzzle compared to 15 puzzle. Now it turns out that to solve a 24 puzzle using Manhattan distance, in fact, we will notice that even if you are using A star search, with a version of A star search, we'll talk called IDA star, which won't make you die because of the space. So it's like an iterative version of A-star search. It'll take 65,000 years on average as of 3 years back when I copied this slide from somebody. So it may be probably only 15,000 years right now, okay, but still pretty bad. Okay, so you need a better heuristic. Manhattan doesn't work. Now, Manhattan essentially makes some abstractions. To improve the heuristic, you want to reduce the level of your abstraction. Remember, that's what we did for the plane problem too. You know, ignoring all obstacles to considering them circular to considering them polygonal. Okay, in Manhattan distance, ignoring all rules of law and just flying to where you need to go is the first idea. The second idea is, I will at least not fly, I will walk to the place where I need to go. And in this puzzle, I can only walk in the Manhattan distance way. So the question is, what is the next idea? What are the other types of heuristics that you can get for Manhattan distance such that you don't have to wait for 15,000 years? What? So here is the interesting thing. So let's actually understand why Manhattan distance works, because Manhattan distance fails. It fails basically because we are assuming away all the interactions. You assume that each tile can go to its position acting as if nobody exists. Now that's what we did, that's to get done faster in the estimation phase. Now the question that we want to ask is, if you want to get a better estimate, you need to pay for it. You do need to pay more for the better estimate. I'll show you a way of computing. Okay, here. Consider the following idea. Remember that this is a, 15 puzzle. Remember that there are 15 tiles whose positions matter. Initial state versus goal state positions of the 15 tiles matter. Right? I want to start abstracting and say, not all of you are equally losers, some of you are chosen few. Okay? I want to make sure that the chosen few are happy. And the rest, I could care less. And if this chosen few, if I increase the number of chosen few to be 15, then I'm basically solving the entire problem. Okay? Now, normally one idea for, you know, tile puzzles is, one convention is, let's assume that the goal is always correctly ordered tiles, 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 15. So that's generally the goal, unless I tell you otherwise. You can have other goals, but if I don't tell you otherwise, the goal is to put them in the right order. Okay? Now, remember that any puzzle position that is in the right order will have these guys in these positions. Yes or no? So I have decided that these are my chosen few. Okay? 3, 7, 11, 15, 12, 13, 14. Those are my chosen few. I will make sure that they get to their right position. Other people, I couldn't care. I won't care. So to make it clear that I don't care, what do? If I don't want to care about you, I'll put a little mask on you so that all of you look brown paper bag like, okay? Except for the five of you I care about. So I just remove the numbers on the time. So now I could have, there are two tiles. Give me two numbers which are present here, 1 and 5, and a position where 1 here and 5 here, versus another one where 1 is here and 5 is here. They both correspond to the same state because they look exactly the same as far as you're concerned. This is an abstraction. Would you agree? It's an abstraction because ultimately whatever is the right solution, you need to get these in the position. So the work that you do to get these into the positions is a lower bound, has to be a lower bound on getting everybody into the position. It may well be that these are like the most important, truly, truly the most important pieces. So by the time you get them into the right position, everybody gets into the right position automatically, in which case you still are less than or equal to. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. So here is a way of abstracting where I say I will keep some of the features of the goal state and I would ignore the rest of the features of the goal state. And then given a state, so now having these are the only features, then I assume that the other tiles don't exist at all. So whenever I have a state during the search, I will basically only consider the privileged guys and set myself a search problem of how do I go from this to this position. Okay, acting as if all others are equal. So I'll do only legal moves. I'll only do legal moves. I won't walk over people, but all the rest of the people are equal as far as I'm concerned. All the rest of the tiles are equal as far as I'm concerned. So clearly, in this case, there are more goal states because there are more states which have these things here than the states where everything is in the right place. So it's a cheaper problem. Remember I said in the beginning of the class that having more goal states makes the problem easier. Okay? So if I compute that bound, now in this particular case it turns out that Manhattan distance between these two configurations is 19 moves, but it takes at least 13 moves to go from this configuration to this configuration. Yes? You don't care about them.
Are they treated as blanks?
No, they're not treated as blanks. They're treated as seat warmers. Exact, you know, idea.
So
they're treated as like seat warmers. So you can't walk over them. You still have to make your way around it. But, you know, they don't. So the idea, as I said, the only difference is if this was 1 and this was 5 in one state, and in another state this is 1, this is 5, as far as you're concerned, both of them are the same state. And the fewer distinctions you see between states, the easier your life is. Okay? Now, so if I'm trying to solve this, so for every node, for every state, so for example, if I'm in this position to get to this position, again, I remember, I'm assuming that the goal is always correctly ordered tiles. For this position, the number is 28. It takes at least 28 moves to go from this position to this position if you ignore all other tiles. And these numbers are guaranteed to be lower bounds. And so what I would suggest is make a database. You know, when you have no other work to do, go ahead and solve for each such state configuration. Okay, find the distance to here. And populate a database. And during search, you look at the configuration. Remember, the only configuration that matters are these red tiles. Populate and look and hash into this database using the configurations of the red tiles and find out what the number is, and that's the heuristic that you get. This idea is called pattern database heuristic. Way costlier. Pattern database heuristic is way costlier than Manhattan distance heuristic or the misplaced tiles heuristic in terms of computation. Okay, so you feel as if estimate should not take any time. The faster you get done with the estimate, the better off you are. But in fact, let me show you a slide. This is another of these great slides that you just have to internalize it. I am showing this slide in terms of a bunch of heuristics for the same problem. Okay? Now, in this case, I actually wrote the heuristics for the plane problem, for the planar obstacle problem. So this was HD, which is essentially just disappearing act heuristic, where it just takes the straight line cost. Then this is circular abstraction, this is polygonal abstraction, this is the perfect, no abstraction. Okay? Suppose on my x-axis I will put the points on the x-axis are the heuristics, with H star being here. I'll only consider for now admissible heuristics. So they're all lower bounds. Okay? I want you to look at two different curves. Okay? The curve one is this curve. This is the seductive curve that you're always looking at. This curve says, how much time do you spend computing just the heuristic during the entire search? Clearly, H0, by the way, says the heuristic value is 0 for every state. Very fast. That's exactly what uniform cost search does. Okay? HD at least has to do a square root over x1 minus x2 square plus y1 minus y2 square. HC could be costlier because it actually takes circular abstraction. The same argument can be made for tile puzzles where H0 is 0 and all the distances are 0. This could be the misplaced tile heuristic. This could be the Manhattan distance heuristic. And this is your pattern database heuristic. The cost of computing the heuristic increases as you go this direction. So if all that matters is you're a subcontractor who is only judged on how much time you spend in computing the heuristic, what should you do? Just go with the cheapest heuristic possible. Okay? Cheapest heuristic possible. Now, the other cost that you should actually be very interested in is if you are using this heuristic, how much work do you do during the search in terms of number of expansions of the nodes? Number of expansions of the nodes. That's a very important cost. It was that you're trying to reduce by improving the heuristic. Okay? At H equal to the dumbest heuristic, you'd wind up doing huge amounts of search. Right? For perfect heuristics, you would wind up doing no search whatsoever. You go directly to the search node. I'll show you examples as to how that happens in HSTAR. For perfect heuristics, you just go directly to the search node. So this guy is going like this, this guy is going like this. What is, if you have no subcontractor, then you are being judged on this curve, which is the summation of those two curves. At each x point, you sum the value here and the value here, and that would be the value there. Okay? Do you see that this would sort of go like that? To the extent these are like this, this would go like this. Right? In terms of figuring out what is the best heuristic to use for a problem, you are trying to figure out this magic point. You're trying to figure out this magic point. This is where the total cost is the lowest. Okay? And you, now the real question, that much, up to that much is obvious. You're trying to figure out where the magic point is. Now, in the old days of AI, which is like 10 years back, okay, people would assume that this minimum will appear somewhere here. So the curves are in such a way that for most problems, the minimum is likely to appear closer to the really cheapo heuristics. That's why if you take a intro to AI class, you'll only hear about Manhattan distance heuristics, straight line distance heuristics. So you keep thinking that heuristics should be no-brainer. You should not spend any time. But what this curve is saying, of course, is so the assumption was that if you buy, you know, the problem, so this was an assumption about the meta structure of the world. People just assumed, and there was no proof, they just assumed that, you know, if you were to draw these kind of curves, their minimum would be here. 10 years later, now, we now know that, in fact, for many, many problems, the minimum is not going to be very close to here. And if you are lucky at all, it won't be too close to here either. It's somewhere in between. And in fact, heuristics such as pattern database heuristics would not even be considered by people. Now, first, somebody has to consider an idea enough that they'll sit down and write a program for it. Okay? People wouldn't even consider something like a pattern database heuristic as something that will do better than Manhattan distance heuristic. You understand what I'm saying? Mental blocks are the worst blocks because that stop you from trying ideas. And here's the point where I'm trying to say that for the longest time in the heuristics, people always looked for heuristics that are easy to compute. But that's not the only thing you're being charged for. You're being charged for not just the cost of computation of the heuristic, but the cost of search with that heuristic. And you already know that there's a really, really cheap heuristic, which is h equal to zero, and that doesn't go anywhere. So much of what is happening in the in AI in general, and you'll see this in many times, is there is a growing realization that this minimum may well be corresponding to somewhat hard to compute heuristics. These are still cheaper to compute than the entire problem, but they are not pennies. You know, if the cost of computing the perfect heuristic is $10,000, these may be $100 instead of being pennies. Okay, that's essentially the point. And for example, pattern database heuristics have been shown to be the very best heuristics for the tile puzzle problem. And the idea of pattern databases works across other problems too. So any problem where I define a goal state in terms of, let's say, 15 or 20 features. In this case, the features happen to be the tile position. But suppose I have, 15 or 20 goal things that must hold in my goal state. Okay, I can start saying, of these, I'll only care about 5 of them. Those are the most important ones. And I'll only consider the distance to go from where I am to one of the states where those 5 are in the correct configuration. Okay, as an example, suppose I, in a normal day-to-day world, I might care about such things as, am I in the class or not? Am I wearing the red shirt or not? Am I wearing my shoes correctly or not? All of these are features that you can use to describe your current state. And a reasonable abstraction might be to just say, forget about my shoelace color, forget about my shirt size. Some things are important, such as being in the class. So I'll only make sure that given any state, I'll ignore the differences between the state in terms of, so going from any state to a state where the important state variables have the values that they're supposed to have, such as, being in class, I hope that the goal is true, not false. Okay, in which case you just look for the distance on that, forget about the rest of the state variables. This bounds up being useful for any general problem solving task. Okay, so the pattern databases, where the patterns are defined in terms of the problem. Okay, for example, polygonal abstractions for shortest path problems are much costlier than circular abstractions for shortest path problems, and yet they're actually better on the plane. You understand what I'm saying? Because their global minimum is actually better than the other guys. I mean, the total cost for them is cheaper than the other guys' total cost. That's the only thing that matters. Okay? And then we'll see when we do planning, we will see that there are cheaper heuristics and there are heuristics called reachability heuristics and planning graph heuristics. They're much costlier to compute compared to the cheaper ones at any rate. So if you look at pattern database heuristics of this kind, computing this database of all patterns is, even if you don't know how to do this, computing the database of all these patterns is much costlier than computing the Manhattan distance and misplaced tiles, right? Agreed? Or should I ask you to do this for the project one? Much costlier. Okay, now I want to end this particular segment of the discussion by saying it's not as costly as you think it may be. That's it. The idea is not to compute this pattern database one pattern at a time. Assume that the goal state, for making our life simple, assume that the goal state is always correctly configured tiles. okay, then what I would do is I will start from the goal configuration. I will start from the goal configuration, whiten all the tiles which are not in the fringe. The pattern that I'm looking at is the fringe. Right? Whiten all the tiles which are not in the fringe, and now start going from this position to all other legal positions. Now, in a tile problem, the only things that you can do is move the blank up, move the blank down, move the blank right, move the blank left. So it's at most four branching factor tree. Now, in some problem, some particular node, there are not all four are possible. But some maximum four are possible. So start from the goal configuration, start generating in the breadth first fashion. I'm saying breadth first, and that's like supposed to be the bad thing to say. But in the breadth first, or a uniform cost search fashion, you know, the entire tree. And every time you look at a configuration of the board, hash it. The first time you look at it is the cheapest time you looked at, because you're going the breadth first way, right? Hash its cost into a hash table. So you just do one backward pass, and you compute the pattern database. And for all possible initial states, you now have a pattern database waiting for you. Not only all possible initial states, all the intermediate states that come from that initial state, you have a pattern database waiting for you. It's still much costlier than computing straight line distance and misplaced time. But it's not as bad as you thought it would be. So you should not lose your essential cleverness. Okay, you should try to avoid redoing work. In this case, it's the easiest thing, because you might as well amortize the cost, because everybody's value is needed. You might as well amortize the cost for individual searches by just developing the entire breadth first tree. Except this breadth first tree is much smaller, because a state in this breadth first tree can correspond to possibly exponential number of real states, where the guys with masks on them will remove their masks and they're actually different configurations. Okay? So this, to some extent, as far as A-star search is concerned, the most important thing is, where do heuristics come from? And if you understand this discussion, you have a grasp on that. Okay? Because it's an art form, but it's not an art form without any rules. The art comes from abstracting the problem. The more abstraction you do, the cheaper it is to compute the heuristic, but the less effective it is going to be. And I want you to understand that pattern databases are abstractions, where you essentially said some, these are abstractions, where the abstraction is, I just ignored these guys. The middle guys, I just act as if they're all white. So they don't, they don't have any individuality. Okay, so that's the abstraction I'm doing. Okay. Questions on this stuff? So I was here in the beginning of the class, and then I made this long detour on where the heuristics come from, which is supposed to be the second part of the talk. It just became the first part. So now we'll come back to the first part, which is, if you do have a heuristic, how do you do the actual mechanics of doing the A-star search? Each are important, but somehow this is cheaper to understand than the other one. The other one is deeper. Okay, this one, you know, you read the textbook, you'll understand, but I'll explain it to you later. So you are now going to prioritize the queue in terms of F function rather than G function, F equal to G plus H. Now it turns out that if your priority function is in terms of F, then pretty much everything you have seen till now, including uniform cost search and the breadth first search, become special cases of this. You know, breadth first search is a special case where G of N equal to D of N and H of N equal to 0. Did you understand what I just said? In the breadth first case, G is equal to the depth of the node, and heuristic H is 0, always. Uniform cost search, G of N equal to G of N, H of N equal to 0. A star search, G and H are both non-zero. And now I talked about how to get the right H. Okay? Now having figured out some H, then as long as that H is less than H star, you can guarantee that you would be And so you basically prioritize the open list in terms of this F value. At every point, you pick the node which has the lowest F value. If it is a goal, you stop. If not, you expand it. Put its children back onto the queue, reprioritize the queue in terms of the F values. Now, when you put the children back onto the queue, you are actually computing their heuristic values at that time on demand, adding their G values to those H values, getting the F values, and you are merging into a sorted list, because open list is originally sorted, and you are introducing new guys into the sorted list. So you do a merge sort in terms of F value. And then always pick the guy from the front of the queue. That's it. Okay? Now, let's do some examples. That's our graph again. And suppose the G values are shown in the graph. I'm sorry, the C values, the cost of going from one node to other node is shown in the graph. Okay? And then, so of course, once you have the cost, you can compute the G during the search. Okay? Now, the H values are path independent. Remember that the G value for a node depends on the path you took to get to that node. The H value is independent of the path you took to get there. Irrespective of how you got there, if you got here, you are a loser because you're too far away from the goal. Now, if you want to figure out how long I took to get here, you know exactly all the places you visited on the way to compute the cost. Okay? So anyway, the H function is essentially path independent, and you just give it for each node. Okay? Now, remember that the H function takes, the way the H functions that we discussed till now are closed form functions, which will take the node, the goal state, and give you a number. But as far as the problems are concerned, ultimately you can assume that the HN is explicitly given. You can, at least conceptually, assume that they're explicitly given. And if you understand how to do a star search doing that, then you also understand what to do it if you have to compute the H function on demand. Okay? So suppose this is my H function. Okay? Is this admissible? Is this admissible? So I did a lot of theory now, the simple practice. It's not admissible. Why is it not admissible? 28. So from C, the H says you are 28 away from G. But we know actually the true cost, you know that the true cost is 25.1, which is lower than 28. So you overestimate it. Okay, so in this case, by looking at the entire thing, you know that it's inadmissible. Okay, that you understood. Remember that admissibility is a global property. If you overestimate even in one node, then you are inadmissible. Okay, even if you are well-behaved all the time, except one guy, one state where you are overestimating, you're still inadmissible. Simple as that. Okay, here is another heuristic. Is this admissible? Is this admissible? Remember, to check admissibility, you have to, in essence, you hopefully never have to check admissibility this way in real world problems, because there are gazillion billion states and you are not going to look at each of them. Hopefully, the way you check admissibility of a heuristic will never be, if you ever have to check the admissibility of a heuristic in real world, it would be the case that the heuristic would be given to you as a closed form function, and you use your mathematical knowledge to figure out that there is a proof that this closed form function can never overestimate the distance. Okay, but here I'm giving you a tabular function. For each node, I'm giving you the actual. For each state, I'm giving you the H value. Is this admissible? All I need to do is to go to every state and check whether its true cost from that state is more or greater than or equal to the estimate that I gave. Okay, yes, it's admissible. Is there something weird about this heuristic? And in asking this, I ask you the following question. Consider the F value of B. Consider F value of B. Okay? The F value of B would be the G value of B, which is 0.1, plus the H value of B, which is 8.8, which is 8.9. Now, what is the F value actually estimating? If H value estimates how far you have to go to the goal node, and G value estimates exactly how long you travel to get here. What is S value estimating? The total path, that the length of the optimal length path that goes through you. That's what it's estimating. F value is an estimate of the length of the optimal path that goes through that node. Okay? That's what it does. Now, so what I said in 8 point, when I put F of B is 8.9, in essence what I'm saying is the length of the optimal path that goes through B to the goal node is 8.9, at least. It may be more, but it is at least 8.9. What about F of C? F of C is 0.1 plus 0.1, that's the G value, which is 0.2, plus H value is 0. So the length of the optimal path that goes through C is only 0.2. This is magic, because every optimal path that goes through C, the node C, has to have gone through its parent. So either your father is wrong or you are wrong. Either your mother is wrong, you are wrong. And we always defer to our parents in these kinds of scenarios. In particular, if your estimate has any sense at all, then you can't be cheaper. And so the path going through C, the estimate of path going through C, cannot be cheaper than the estimate of path going through B, because there are more paths that go through B than through C, because every path that comes through C in a search node C will have to have gone through its parent to it. So the parent has more options, and they're taking the min over that, and you have less options and you're taking the min over that. So clearly, if your parent says 8.8, then you can't be less than 8.8. Well-behaved heuristics will always have the property that the F value is non-increasing on any path. Well-behaved heuristics have the property that F value is non-increasing on any path from the root node to any node. Okay? And non-well-behaved heuristics, which may still be admissible, in this case this heuristic is actually admissible, but it's not well-behaved. In fact, the name you use for well-behavedness here is monotonicity. Okay? A heuristic is called monotonic if, in fact, an admissible heuristic is called monotonic if, in fact, the F values will always be non-decreasing on any path in the search tree. And it makes a perfect sense for a heuristic to be monotonic, because if it's not monotonic, then it's kind of misleading. It's saying that somehow the min over a larger set can be larger than the min over a subset. Okay? So the interesting thing is that a heuristic might be admissible but not monotonic. And to avoid this problem, we just do the needful. We slap C silly and say, look, you can't be that good. You can't be better than your father. And that's what everybody says to C. And so if you think, so what I'll wind up taking is, I'll take the F value of C to be the F value that I compute in terms of G of C plus H of C, the max of that value and the F value of its parent. So it will never be better than its parent. If you do that, then a heuristic that's not monotonic is now forced to be monotonic. Now it looks as if I'm just trying to be politically correct. But not being monotonic can only be bad for your search. Because as I said, you are stating that the minimum over a larger set can be larger than a minimum over a subset of this larger set. That's just impossible. Okay, because there are more paths that go through that guy, and a subset of them go through this guy. And how can it be that this guy has found gold where the father didn't? The estimate makes no sense. So this change that we do is called path max adjustment. One of the interesting things is most reasonable heuristics, including the straight line distance, right? Including the straight line distance and the Manhattan distance and the misplaced tile heuristic, all of these wind up out of the box monotonic. So you never have to do this. And by the way, if you think of h as a distance, an actual true distance, I mean f values and h values as actual true distances, then in essence, what we are saying is the following. Is n1, distance from n1 to g, distance from n2, the total distance from n2 to g, and distance between n1 and n2. It's a triangle. What comes to mind, if you are a Google, what comes to mind if I say triangle and distance? Triangle inequality. Okay, triangle inequality says the sum of two sides must be larger than or equal to the third side. And if a distance metric does not satisfy triangle inequality, then it's not a good distance metric. If it's not, we will hit it on the head and make it a good distance metric by doing this max. Okay, some nice interesting connections between what we are doing in terms of heuristics and, you know, what makes a distance well behaved, because triangle of inequality has to be valid. Okay. Now, let's now finally do something that I probably should have done at the very beginning of the class, which is just show an example of HR search working on this node, on this particular graph. So, node 0, I start with node 0, and so which corresponds to the state A, which has value 0, because its G value is 0, and its H value is actually 7, so in fact, instead of writing 0 there, I should have written 0 plus 7. So that's the F value. But it doesn't matter what I give for the first guy, right? Because he's the only guy who's on the queue when I pick him up. In the very beginning of the search, I actually, you know, initialize my search queue with node 0, and then I pick it up for expansion. So the actual F value for A is 0 plus 7. And I'll change that when I go in. Okay, so now I expand it, I'll get node 1 and node 2, one corresponding to B, one corresponding to G, and then this guy's F value is 0.1 plus 8.8, the other one is 9 plus 0. Okay, and then I pick whichever is the lowest F value in the fringe, and in the fringe the lowest F value is still B, the node N1, so I expand that, I'll get node N3, okay, whose F value is now set as the max of the F value of the parent and the F value that you would compute for just this node. Okay, in this particular case, since it's not monotonic, you do this. You can act as if you always do this, and if it's a monotonic heuristic all the time, then you would never wind up picking the parent in the max. If it isn't, then you would have made it monotonic by doing this. Okay, and then so you, in this particular case, it will be 8.8, right? I'm sorry, it should be 8.9. I made too many mistakes in this. 8.9, okay? And so N3 hasn't reduced. I'm sorry, the F value hasn't increased. It's still non-decreasing F value, okay? And then it still is less than 9, so I pick it for expansion. I get N4, which is D, okay? At this point, I've got 25.3 as the F value. So then I pick the other side, N2, try to expand it, find that it's a goal node, and A*. This is A*. This is A* for this particular heuristic. Okay? The green one, this heuristic, what is this heuristic? Is this admissible for this problem? I'm sorry, I just sprained my ankle as I was talking in the class, so I'm sitting more often. Is this admissible heuristic? What's interesting about this heuristic? It's actually the perfect heuristic. It's the thing. If you have perfect heuristic, what do you think should happen for A* search? Go to the goal node. It should directly go to the goal node. Right? It should directly go to the goal node. Let's see if it does. So I start with A0. I get these two nodes. One is 24.2 plus 0.1, and the other is 9 plus 0. So you pick the lower F value, which is that, and you say, hey, that's a goal, I start. The important thing is, because the heuristic is admissible, when you stop, you are automatically guaranteed to be optimal. I can come up with inadmissible heuristics, which will make you stop with the optimal goal, but there is no guarantee, because I could also have changed the distance function such that you could have stopped with the inoptimal goal. But if the heuristic is admissible, I can't fool you. I just cannot fool you. If the heuristic is admissible, when you pick a node for expansion using the priority of F, and you say it's done, I mean it's a goal node, you're guaranteed to be optimal. Okay? Shall I do this? No, I'll do this next class. Let me do a couple of other things. Okay. So what does A star search do? In essence, if you think in terms of, remember, uniform cost search starts from the node and goes in circles. In particular, uniform cost search can be guaranteed to show that it will never expand a node of value g equal to g1 before expanding a node of g equal to g2, where g2 is less than g1. So it will always expand nodes in the increasing order of their g value. What such statement can I make for the A star search? It will always expand nodes in the increasing order of their F value. In particular, there is an F star, which is the cost of the optimal, the evaluation cost of the optimal goal node. Okay, and you will always expand nodes whose F value is less than F star. Whose F value is less than F star. Now, why did I say that I can take F star without caring about how bad the heuristic is? Remember, I said F star for the goal node, which is the optimal F value. Now, I talked a lot about how heuristics can be underestimating, overestimating, etc., etc., etc. Why doesn't it matter when I talk about the F value of the goal node? What should the admissible heuristic give as the distance for a goal node? What should be the H value for a node which happens to be a goal node? If it isn't zero, it's not admissible. Right? So all admissible heuristics must give H value equal to zero for the goal node, because you're already in the goal. Where do you want to go? So F value of a goal node is just the G value of that goal node. So F star is nothing but G star. Now, uniform cost search is essentially expanding circles, I mean expanding all nodes of equal G's and the next equal G's, next equal G. And this guy is expanding all nodes of equal F, next equal F, next equal F. And the F's can be, F's are being influenced by the H estimate, and so they start looking more and more directional and go towards the goal. In the very best case, where you have perfect heuristic, it goes directly. So this is a picture you want to remember. Then one last slide, and then you get to go home. I just have to remember what is the order in which I did this. Properties of A star. Remember, all other guys we had to talk about how much space do they take, how much time do they take, how many expansions do they make, all that fun stuff. Why not this guy, right? So is A star complete? Yes, it's complete for pretty much the same reason uniform cost search is complete. Okay, I will actually provide couple more proofs of this next term, in the beginning of the next class. But you know, by now you sort of know why it would be complete. Okay, and so again, it is complete unless there are infinitely many nodes whose F value is less than the F value of the goal node. And for there to be infinitely many nodes whose F value is less than the F value of the goal node, it better be the case that there are zero cost arcs. And what did I say last class? You cannot have zero cost arcs or negative cost arcs. You have to have non-zero cost arcs, arc being the action cost. Even if you take epsilon as the lower bound on the cost, which is greater than zero, then this cannot be true, and so you would complete. It may take forever, but you'll complete. Okay? Time. Now, what's interesting about time is, A star, in the best case, H equal to H star, it expands nodes that are directly on the optimal path to the goal node. So it takes linear number of expansion. It's actually equal to, takes the number of expansions is equal to the length of the path. In the worst case, where h equal to 0, which is also a star, it's just called uniform cost. When h equal to 0, it expands the exponential number of nodes. What about the average case? Now, what's interesting is that the average case depends on how far is your estimate of the perfect heuristic from the perfect heuristic. Clearly, you would agree that. Okay, remember that the estimate is always less than the h star, and the closer you are to h star, the better off you are likely to be. Now, the interesting thing is that this, in particular, what you care about is the relative error, h star minus h by h star. Okay, this quantity, relative error, h star minus h by h star, and the cost of, the number of expansions that h star does is exponential on that parameter. It's exponential on that parameter. So it actually becomes linear only when h minus h star equal to 0, and all other times it's just a slower raising exponent. In all of search, you would see these beautiful curves. Curve 1, which goes like this in terms of solution depth. So if you have solution at depth 1, 2, 3, etc., optimal solution. You know, a really bad search algorithm goes like this, a slightly better search algorithm goes like this, a somewhat even better search algorithm goes like this, and the perfect search algorithm kind of goes like this, which is length. So all of these essentially are exponential curves, except the exponent is small. And in improving a heuristic, all you are hoping for is postponing the inevitable by reducing the raise of the exponent. That's what you wind up doing. And you can't change that. The only way you can improve the only way you can make it linear is to have the perfect heuristic, which is too costly, which is costlier than the original problem. And what I did in that whole discussion about heuristics was, you do have to consider heuristics that are not too cheap to get good performance sometimes. And the final point, and then, we already talked about optimality. Okay, I'll again touch this on next class when we come, but we talked about it enough. The final question is space. What is the space consumption of A-star search? A-star search, in the worst case, can do as badly as a breadth first search. So in that particular case, it winds up taking exponential space. So A-star search does bad space management. It can run out of space. Okay? And so, you know one trick to reduce the space consumption. You do iterative deepening depth first search, except now the depth, previously the iterative deepening was in terms of level by level by level. So G1, G2, G3, that's the levels you are taking previously, iterations that you're taking. You're an A star, you do F1, F2, F3. If you cut the tree in terms of its F values, I'll go back again next class on the IDA star. This is called IDA star. If you cut the tree in terms of its F values, and in each tree you do depth first search, then you are guaranteed in each iteration to only take linear space. You do extra work, but you'll still be taking linear space. The question, the final question is, how many iterations can you take? It can be as many iterations as there are distinct F values. As many iterations as there are distinct F values. In the IDDFS, there were as many iterations as there are distinct D values, which are the depths. For a tree of depth 10, there are 10 depth values. So you would do 10 iterations. Now, but here you have non-uniform cost actions, and you also have this H function. So my favorite is, take an H function, add random noise to it, just a little random noise, zero mean random noise. So everybody would be unique in, 15th decimal place. So all the F values are now guaranteed to be unique. And so how many iterations will there be? B power D iteration. So that is a problem. But to the extent you have reasonably behaved heuristics, the number of iterations in the worst case is B power D. In the best case, maybe it's much less. Okay, so we'll talk about IDEA star a little bit more. We'll talk about the optimality of A star search a little bit more next class, and then go into local search algorithms.